Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today I'm proud to bring you The Creative Process with Nick Curto. Greetings and welcome, Nick. How are you today?
Oh, never better, Hercules, in Manhattan. And it's the holiday season, and the shopping is in full swing. Needless to say, the decorations in the stores are probably the best they've ever been. And if anybody's in the area, don't miss just seeing the windows on not only Macy's, but all over Fifth Avenue, especially in the 50s. And also Madison Avenue has some interesting displays too. So if you're going to be in the area, don't miss just taking a look at the windows. They're terrific.
I haven't lived in New York for many years, but I did live in New York for decades before moving out to Pennsylvania and then to New Jersey. And I do miss that. I remember the Hollywood bustle and all the lights and colors and all the displays. So I'm motivated to come down there sometime soon just to experience it again.
That would be terrific. I hope you can do that and bring your wife and really enjoy. New York does up her holidays really, really well. And it really is probably the best it's ever been. And there's a lot of people now, right now, as we speak, on Fifth Avenue doing a lot of shopping. So it's going well. And it's a beautiful sunny day here, too.
And thank you for adding to the Christmas season, the holiday season, with your show on creativity, because New York is bustling with creativity right now, motivated by the holidays. And you always bring more creativity into the minds of our listeners.
Well, thank you very much, Hercules. And, you know, creativity is such an important, aspect for everybody. You really need to tap into your creativity, and that can be on many different levels and forms. I mean, some people are painters, poets, writers, sculptors, but there's all kinds of other kinds of creativity not to be overlooked. For instance, baking and cooking,
yes.
Trying to be creative about what you're doing. And sometimes
I'm a believer in expressing yourself as often as uniquely as you possibly can. And you're right. It doesn't have to be public artistry. It could be private artistry, how you paint your house, what type of pictures and other things you put on the wall, what type of tchotchkes you put on surfaces. Each one of them is unique and expresses themselves uniquely. So if you're going to do it anyway, why not do it creatively?
Absolutely, and I really do encourage that. I'm all about, really, all my life has been encouraging people to tap into that wonderful area of creativity that everybody has. And if you try to tap that and do something creative, you'll be surprised at what you can come up with. And, of course, being creative, when you're creating something, it's something that hasn't happened before. It's your own personal work.
And by extension, people don't realize that we could use that creativity to improve or change the quality of our lives. You know, we could use the same talent that we use to make a killer omelet to really create a better life for ourselves and the lives of the people around us just by using this faculty. I've always believed that creativity is our most divine faculty because you take something that doesn't exist and you bring it into existence.
I could not agree with you more. In fact, and you don't even know this yet, but a couple of my programs coming up in the months ahead are going to be people who have created jobs for themselves by tapping into their creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really unique idea when you're tapping into something that you like and that you're creating and then creating an actual paying job. From that, and there's going to be a couple of interviews I'm going to be doing, and some wonderful people who have embraced that exact thought.
Oh, I'm looking forward to those shows.
Okay, well, again, today, this is The Creative Process, and I'm Nick Curto, your host, And just to say that creativity taps into some of the best of you, your skills, your knowledge, and you're willing to try something new and to not be afraid to go ahead and do something you haven't done before. If you want to try a poem, go ahead. My art teacher, I majored in advertising graphic design, but one of my professors said, when you don't know what to do and you're doing a drawing or a painting, just put something on the canvas or paper. Just go ahead and do that and then say, well, you know, it should be this, and then add to it. And before you know it, you're coming up with something that wasn't there before, and it can actually be quite wonderful. And another one I'll never forget, she said, when you don't know what to do design-wise, multiply, multiply, multiply. And that, you can see a lot of major artists who do things just like that. Anyhow, today on the program, I am so excited, truly excited to have a very dear friend and a very gifted artist with us today, my dear friend, Carol Cannon. Carol, welcome. A warm welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick, and thank you, Hercules. And it's a pleasure to be with you on this sunny Saturday morning.
It's beautiful. It really is. And Carol, I've seen your creativity, and it's taken many forms. And today we're going to be talking about your recent art show, which I was very privileged to be invited to and go to, and I was absolutely knocked over with the amount of creativity I saw on the walls of both you as an amazing visual artist, and we're going to go into that, and also your partner. And so would you please tell our listeners a little bit about the concept for your latest art show and a little bit about what was involved?
Well, I'm so happy you made the effort to come out from Manhattan to come to this show that I titled, as you know, it was the first time that I dared to exhibit my work with this well-known Moroccan artist who died in 1985 that I was very close with. His name is Ahmed Yacoubi. And, you know, I've always revered him and his work, but he's been gone, you know, all these years, and yet I've continued to try to keep people aware of his genius and his work. And so thanks to the space that I had available to me on the floor where I have my studio in Long Island City, they finally gave us permission to start having shows after COVID, and I was the first one to reopen the gallery with this joint exhibition. And the reason why I titled it Grok Twice is because both of us, in terms of this two artists, myself and Ahmed Yacoubi, worked in a intuitive fashion. And if you had ever read Robert Heinlein's book, Stranger in a Strange Land, you would know that the meaning of the word grok, G-R-O-K, means to completely understand, you know, just totally, intellectually, intuitively, in every fashion that we perceive that we understand something. So if I grok you, it means that I just get what you're all about. And so I believe that when people see the work of either myself or Ahmed Yacoubi, that it's an intuitive understanding that happens. And so you can intellectually approach it and discuss it and analyze it, but it hits you on a deeper level. And so not only is it supposed to replace the word of, you know, look twice or think twice before doing something, but grok twice is that you look at a painting and you think, oh, no, could it be that? And you look again, it's like, yes, this is really what my first impression was. And with the case of Ahmed Yacoubi's work, his abstract oil paintings are multi-layered and entirely suggestive faces and figures and scenes and, you know, events that are happening, and yet they're not literally rendered. And so it's up to the viewer to define, you know, what is really, what they're really seeing. So you're seeing everything through your own filter of perceptions. And so with my work, it's very gestural, and so people have to sort of get it on a kinesthetic basis, like your guts have to just read the meaning of the strokes or the meaning of the patterns, and, you know, trying to, you know, interpret it on an intellectual level won't go very far, but your instincts understand it.
No, Carol, I noticed that when people look at your work or your partner, your dearest friend, that they stay on looking at that particular art piece for a very, very long time. And it's because of what you just said, because they're looking deep into it. They're looking at various parts of it as well as the whole. And it kind of commands your attention to really look deeply into it, and to it creates a feeling, an emotion sometimes, or a level of, what shall I say, a visual understanding of color and form. And some of that is very subtle. Other times it's really quite aggressive and interesting too. It can run the gamut of that. And the works were, that's why they were so interesting, because there was a variety of expressions in the various artworks where you're really feeling this. And I was just delighted to see people really looking deep. Did you notice that too?
You know, I wouldn't have said that, because I was so busy trying to make sure everything was going well. But the photographer that was there for the first half of the show did capture a couple of shots of people looking at the pieces from different angles and going up close. And so I'm just glad to hear you say it, because I just was assuming that's what people do at exhibitions. But to think that they really did pause a little longer than average, because I think, you know, statistics show that most people that go to museums spend something like, I don't know, 36 seconds in front of each piece. I mean, it's a really very brief visit. And so to think that they might have spent, you know, maybe 46 seconds on each piece makes me very happy.
Well, I was looking at also with those kind of eyes, and I was staying on some of the more subtle works of color and pattern, and some of it was very dreamlike, I have to say, with the pastel colors and others, which we'll get into, was very, very strong with black and white and huge emotional brush strokes. And I wanted to ask you about that kind of art, because I know that it involves meditation and I would say a great deal of spirituality in creating something that is very expressive and very almost aggressive with your brush strokes. And could you go into that part of your art?
Yes, it's so interesting to hear the adjectives that you're using, because I'm trying to articulate what it's all about in words as I approach, you know, giving a class in January and also start issuing a monthly newsletter. But it all began, this particular big brush painting that I've been doing for the past 10 or 15 years, I started working in ink. I had previously been working in acrylic, and I started experimenting with ink, and I took a brush making class with this woman named Barbara Bash, who is a Buddhist calligrapher, artist, and student. And she had been introduced to traditional Chinese ink painting by doing, you know, very basic characters, the ideograms that the Chinese use to indicate, you know, concepts like man. It's just, you know, three lines. And anyway, she taught this class to a few of us how to make a great big brush out of a horse hair tail, a horse tail. And each of us went home with this giant thing, but we also have the opportunity to use them in this somewhat meditative ceremony, you could call it, where each of us were kneeling on a little meditation pillow, and she'd put out the nice, inexpensive white butcher paper, and we each had a bucket of ink to our right, and we're, you know, we just followed her demonstration, where she would literally bow from her knees. You know, we're all on our knees, and we would bow to the paper. And in this act, to me, I deliberately surrender my thoughts and just ask the universe, the powers that be, to work through me. So when I pick up my brush and do my single brush stroke, I am not trying to control it. I'm just yielding to an impulse that's moving through me. And then I, you know, stop the stroke. I replace the brush back into the bucket, and I bow once again to the paper, because now, the first bow was to, you know, ask to be a vehicle, a conduit of the universe's intelligence. And then the second bow is to thank the force, the intelligence, and the action, and just accept that this stroke is what it was, and that, you know, there is some sort of meaning there, whether I like it subjectively or not. And then, you know, we all took turns, but then we then followed with all doing it simultaneously. So, you know, it was an introduction to sort of having this non-conceptual approach and having that acceptable. And that began the whole process of, for me, joining it with what I had learned in Reiki, which is a hands-on healing system that also originated in the East, and from some people's point of view is actually something that our whole planet was seeded with, in terms of learning how to be a channel of universal life force energy. And so I married the painting with the Reiki, and now ask sometimes the elements, like if I'm working by the ocean, I deliberately ask the water, the waves, the ocean, to move through my body and my arm and my hand and my brush down through the ink. So it's literally a series of stepping down the energy from what I imagine is the very center of all creation, down through the universes, down through the atmosphere, down through the top of my head, through my heart, down through my arm, because the hands are sub-chakras of the heart. And so my hand is delivering the energy through the brush and the ink onto the paper into the earth. And there we go.
Well, thank you for that. Very, very, very interesting. And it's, I think, a fairly new concept for certainly the United States, and I would say parts of Europe, too, that this is a very different way of expression. And it always looks to me very modern, almost futuristic, the way it comes across. And different people will see it different ways. That's another part of this. And I could see, give you an example, I could very easily envision, say, a very big building, corporate headquarters, or a very large building, or even an apartment building that would have huge paintings with this style, even perhaps splashes of color, as well as just black and white, because I think it would lend itself. It looks fresh always. It looks very immediate and fresh, and it would be so welcoming to come into a building and see something like that. So I'm just kind of pointing the way that I think there is a commercial a place for this type of art in major buildings. And I think I could easily see that as a wave of the future.
Well, I'm glad again to hear, you know, your response. It's informing me. And yes, I had always hoped that I would find designers and art advisors that had relationships with corporate buildings, because that's, I do think that that's proportionately where they could, you know, best hang, unless people do have very large lofts or, you know, cathedral ceilings where they can hang these as well. And I have, you know, started to integrate more and more color, because you know, the Asian approach to color is very subtle. It's very, it's mostly extracted from nature. So the colors are, you know, the greens of leaves, and, you know, there's very little sort of primary colors that we're accustomed to in the West. But I'm beginning to integrate the two together, because I love color myself and I miss it. So I'm, the very current, the piece that I'm working on right now has the whole rainbow in it. But yeah, I had always visualized that they would do very well in lobbies, in corporate lobbies. So yes, I'm so glad to hear you say so too.
Absolutely. In my career, I was the art director in corporate communications of the major Fortune 500 company. And they spent a fair amount of money in buying beautiful artworks, oil paintings, and they put them in the various floors of the building for the employees. And it was always such a joy to come into the building and see that, and to go into different floors and see original artworks. And it always added so much to the working environment to see original artworks. It, no matter what your job was, it was just something to enjoy. And I thought they spent their money very, very well doing a major art purchase, and it was a huge building, and it was filled with incredible art, and I loved working there, and also the members, the other employees also loved the fact that they were among artworks. So I'm just kind of pointing the way to say that that is something to be looked at by major companies to, and of course it's also art is a very good investment. And some people spend some of their money in investing in artwork. And also that's another phase of all this. You know, Carol, in this particular program that I do, the creative process, I wish it was on a visual Zoom or something where our listeners could also see what you're speaking of, your artwork, because it's truly a joy, and I would love them to see it. Now, you do have websites, and I very much would like you right now to perhaps slowly, so our listeners might write down a way that they could see some of your work on the internet. So if you'd be good enough to give a way for them to do that. And so, listeners, if you get a piece of paper and a pencil, and Carol will give you a couple of ways where you could see some of her amazing artwork. So, Carol, please go ahead.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to share that. My basic website is simply my name followed by finearts.com. So it's Carol Cannon. So it's CarolCannon, Fine Arts with an S. .com, and that will show initially a slideshow of my ink work, and then if you click on acrylic pieces, you'll see a slideshow of my acrylic work, which is a little different. And then I have a tab for videos that shows my demonstrations of doing this both by the ocean and in the woods, because that will be added to soon. A videographer and I are going to her parents' property upstate to do the video about fire, because I want to do each element, you know, earth, air, water, fire, and metal. So I'm about to produce the fire video. And then, you know, I do have an Instagram account, and it's just under my name, and a couple of Carol Cannons will come up if you certainly see the one with my artwork. And then, of course, there's a Facebook page, and I've never memorized these handles, but I would also like to share that the work of Ahmed Yacoubi, which is much more detailed and layered, is also plentiful on the internet. If you Google his name, A-H-M-E-D is Ahmed, A-H-M-E-D, Yacoubi, Yacoubi.com. And his usual website, I have to double check because I have a new one that's just about to go up under his name, but the AhmedYacoubi.com may be down at this moment because I let my website, CarolCannon.com, expire not knowing it was linked with his. So I'm in the process of talking with the hosting people, getting his back up. But in a few days or few weeks, his brand new website under that name will be available, and it will show a lot more of his paintings and drawings.
Now, Carol, that's another part of what I'd like to explore on this particular podcast, because you gave an amazing talk one evening during your art exhibit about Ahmed and your relationship to him, how you've found each other, and a lot about his art, about how he works, and so forth, and the collections that his artwork is in. So if you will, I would very much like you to share with our listeners much more about Ahmed, and your personal story about how you met, because I found that wonderful when you were speaking at the gallery.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, it was a PowerPoint presentation that I put together rather last minute. It had been something I had wanted to do for a very long time, and the exhibition gave me a purpose to finally do it. But Ahmed was born in 1928 in Fez, Morocco, in a very ancient quarter, and he was born into a very religious Muslim family, and he was the descendant of the Prophet Muhammad on both his mother's and father's side. So he was considered an Idrisi, which is, you know, a very honorable line of people that came from this, I don't know if you call him a monarch, but he was one of the leaders. He was the leader that brought Islam from the Saudi Arabian area to North Africa. So where he settled in this area of Morocco was really sort of the heart of Islam going back to like the 1100s. And, you know, he was highly revered, and therefore his descendants, you know, were always immensely respected. And so Ahmed had the privilege of, you know, being raised with his father, who was considered a holy man, a faqih is the title he had. And he would literally go to people's homes to heal them with, you know, interesting formulas, herbal formulas, or the laying on of hands, and of course the recitation of certain sections of the Quran. So Ahmed learned the Quran from the oral tradition. He did not learn it from the written tradition. So speaking to Ahmed, he could recite some very wise phrase from the Quran that would have an incredible life lesson to it. And so he was just filled with an understanding of the traditions and beliefs of this really ancient world. And the interesting thing that I learned about him after knowing him for a few months was that he was non-literate. He didn't read or write in any language, not only Arabic, but, you know, not only didn't he not know how to read or write English, but he didn't read or write even in Arabic, which was shocking and, you know, is considered usually to be rather shameful. But growing up in his environment, father didn't really want him to go to the French lycée system and learn these Western attitudes. So when Ahmed, and there were two reasons, not only his father's attitude, but when he would go to school, and if he didn't do something right, the teachers would literally hit him with like a hickory stick. And he would run away and go to the mosques and watch people do tiling or leather work and learned all these symmetries and color combinations that they use in the beautiful, you know, tile work in the mosques. And so he sort of absorbed all of these, you know, knowledge, you know, bodies of knowledge through osmosis. And yet, of course, he spoke very well and he learned different languages just through listening and memorization. So he could speak to people in Arabic and French and Spanish and English from just his, you know, learning from his capacity to memorize, you know, oral traditions and systems. So I do believe he was a genius on numerous levels, and, you know, he had to constantly compensate for not reading or writing. So, you know, he had his own systems of, you know, putting combinations of English or Arabic letters that he did learn or numbers in ways to remind himself of things. And so visually, when he started drawing at an early age, never having seen anybody draw anything ever before, you know, he had his own way of putting down images of characters. And there's this term in Arabic called jinn, which were like little mischievous ghosts. And this unseen world came out through his pen and ink drawings. And then when Paul and Jane Bowles, the American writers, were visiting Fez in a hotel, he was a bellhop, and they asked him something, and he used pen and paper to translate and give directions, and they began to recognize he had a real talent, and they wanted to encourage him and nurture him. And so Jane Bowles, she was the playwright between the couple, gave him a set of watercolors, so it expanded his menu from just using an ink pen to watercolors and then pastels. And then he began to travel with them. And so they really were his mentors for a while. And he traveled extensively with Paul Bowles because Paul had been given funding for musical research by UNESCO and the United States Information Organization. So he would go to Iran or Iraq or Ceylon and record musicians for the sake of posterity. And Ahmed would accompany him to help him in translation or, you know, just even for his own companionship. So he got to travel with Paul Bowles to many different interesting areas. And then they started encouraging to have exhibitions. So Yacoubi's first exhibition was in a bookshop in Tangier. And then next it was a show on 57th Street in Manhattan with Betty Parsons, which was the preeminent gallery in Manhattan in the early 1950s. And then that began his entire international career of exhibiting around the world. And he kept developing his art. And I can keep going, but ultimately he learned oil painting and was encouraged by Francis Bacon. And most people probably know of Francis Bacon now, the very important English painter from, you know, England and London. And Yacoubi shared a studio with him for a while, so he really developed his knowledge in his own innovative way of doing oil glazes and began using this imaginative, you know, stream of consciousness with oil glazes. And his paintings became so complex, so intricate, so profound that he really paved his own way that I think has, you know, superseded anybody else's abilities thus far in the world.
You mentioned his line artwork, and I loved that also. I thought that was unique. It drew me to each work. I loved that. I also loved his other areas of expression, too. where it's very free-flowing. It's using color and form, and you're drifting in the canvas. You're drifting your visual sense into almost a dreamlike state again, and it really is unique. It's a unique experience, and I loved his work as well as yours, Carol. I thought it was a wonderful, absolutely amazing display of creativity, and there was quite a number of people the night I was there when you gave your talk, and they were really enjoying every single piece. It was a buzz going on. It was electric, and I will always remember that incredible evening. And you also shared, I thought, a very, very important and interesting aspect, which was how you came to meet Ahmed. And if you would be so kind as to share that with our listeners, I just thought that was a very interesting story about how life kind of puts you in the path of your next adventure, your next friend, your next loved one, and how life sometimes does that. And you look back and you can almost see a pattern that goes on. And I was fascinated with that story. So if you will, please, would you share with us how it came to be that you met him and your life together of exploring? I would very much love that.
Well, thank you for asking. It is, you know, it is kind of an interesting story looking back. At the time, I didn't think anything of it. And I did have available at the exhibition the first chapter of my memoir, which tells the whole story, which I'm hoping will be published soon. But I had just moved to Manhattan based on my father's directive, because I'd stayed out of, you know, I graduated high school. I didn't want to spend my father's hard-earned money on a liberal arts degree because I didn't know that was really going to be what I wanted to do with my life and my time. I really wanted to be very deliberate about what I was going to study and what I was going to do with my life. I had been reading the Urantia book for a few years, and so when I finally told my father from Boulder, Colorado, that the only thing that was a consistent, you know, desire or yearning on my part was that these images would come to me in meditation. And he just gruffly said on the phone, well, there's no place to go to art school but New York. And so I more or less obediently packed up my Volkswagen and drove to Manhattan, you know, naively thinking I was going to have my own little apartment, but not knowing the cost of living here. So I wound up, you know, my father was kind enough to let me have the bedroom in his apartment because my parents had recently divorced. And I had applied to NYU Film School and had gotten accepted, but got the tuition bill and was just shocked. Again, didn't want to impose that expense on my father, so I wound up going to the School of Visual Arts that didn't have a film department yet. So while I was waiting, because that was Christmas time, 1975, and I was waiting for School of Visual Arts to start in September, so I had many months to, you know, amuse myself, and my father encouraged me to go to the Art Students League for classes, you know, part-time classes while I waited. But anyway, ultimately, I wound up getting art supplies at the Utrecht art supply store that was on 3rd Avenue between about 10th and 11th Street, which was only a few blocks from my father's apartment. And one day when I was examining the canvas samples, there was this funny man to my left who was also feeling the linen samples, and he turned to me and he asked if anybody had ever painted my portrait. And I was, you know, really shy and really, you know, flustered and just kind of laughed like, no, because I was very self-conscious about my appearance, and I just sort of drifted to another aisle. And he followed me and was telling me how he used to weave his own canvas. And, you know, we chatted a little bit about this or that. But then ultimately, within a few minutes, I excused myself because I just was feeling uncomfortable. But no sooner did I leave the store and I was walking up 3rd Avenue that I felt my heart sink in my chest, which I think, as I explained, I was not terribly in touch with my body at the time, and it was just unusual for me to feel my heart sink in my chest, but I didn't sink anymore, and I just went home. But then about 3 days later was the 4th of July, and I had taken a book from my step-grandfather, the Kabbalah of Numbers, and was walking down on Canal Street in anticipation of watching the fireworks. And here comes this same funny man on his, with his bicycle. He's walking his bicycle along Canal Street, and he spotted me, and had this great big smile on his face. And I was like, oh, here's the same fellow. And so he asked me if I wanted to go for tea. And I agreed, and we walked up Lafayette Street and turned onto Great Jones and wound up going into this loft building, which I'd never been in, and up into the freight elevator, which is like a steel, great big steel box, which I'd never seen, you know, where you had to operate it by pulling down on a big cable. We got out on the 6th floor, and the first room was just so magical. It had this beautiful Moroccan lantern with different colored glass, you know, casting these beautiful patterns on the walls. And he had this lovely silk, what they call a haiti, which is like a tapestry that has these beautiful arches, these sort of arabesque arches in these beautiful pastel colors. And just everything just had this magical, high quality, you know, feeling of another culture, another era, another world. And then within a few minutes, we went back into the large room that he had turned into this beautiful gallery with this, you know, whitewashed walls, flat painted tin ceilings, and of course his artworks. And when he flipped the spotlights on and they illuminated his paintings, I just was, you know, in awe. I just looked at the paintings and started having this almost like a deja vu experience that I'd seen these paintings before. These were possibly even my paintings of another life. It was just this mysterious, familiar, awestruck feeling of how did this man make these exquisite paintings that were like portals into other realms. I was flabbergasted, and we sat down and we had tea, and I asked him why he wasn't world famous, and he didn't have an explanation, but he did show me his portfolios of the exhibitions he'd had around the world and all the reviews and articles and critics, you know, comments. And so that was the beginning of basically what has become a lifetime relationship.
That is such a wonderful story. It almost seems like a very personal, wonderful movie. The way you're describing it is also very dramatic and just terrific. I could actually see a little movie being made upon your relationship, and you described it so beautifully, and really took us to a very emotional part of your life, and also his too. And now you said that he's been his artwork has been shown worldwide, and also in many collections too. Carol, is that right?
Yes, it was interesting. I don't know if you could say it might have been something characteristic of his astrological chart, but he had this ability to wind up meeting really illustrious people. I mean, everyone from writers and musicians to politicians and, you know, highly successful business people. So his work wound up in collections like not only Peggy Guggenheim and the Museum of Modern Art, but in Helena Rubinstein's, in Stanley Marcus of Neiman Marcus. It's an extensive list that just covers the world. I mean, I should have my list with me because I'm sort of blanking now, but there are very interesting writers and art collectors and business people, even people in Asia, people across all of the, you know, of course, you know, very distinguished Moroccan diplomats, but even countesses and counts, ambassadors. He had a very important show in the most prestigious place to exhibit in Morocco is called the Gallery Babourawah, which is in Rabat, the capital. And this was sort of his pinnacle of success. And I have a copy now. I gave the book, the original, back to his son, but I have made a copy of the book where people would sign in and make comments about his work. And they're in Spanish, in French, in Arabic, all, you know, and of course English, all praising and thanking him for, you know, creating this level of art and giving them this experience of seeing this quality and this heightened sense of imagination, just transporting people. So, yes, he's in really the finest collections of that era. And, you know, today he's in the collection of the Bargiel Foundation, which has been created by Sultan Al-Qassami, who has made it his purpose to collect, you know, the finest, Middle Eastern artists. So there's a very fine painting of his called The Goat's Bones, which is, again, a breathtaking oil painting of just the most lovely layers of tans and browns and blacks that just undulate under his very smooth surface, because that was something characteristic of his paintings, is that he always sheared down each layer. So the surfaces were always smooth as you know, baby skin or glass. And so it was intriguing that you sort of looked into his paintings. They were not, you know, the paint was never textured. It was always highly smooth.
Exactly right. And that's quite a list which you just gave us of collections of some of the major collectors of the world, and how wonderful that his work is in them. Now, I want to also explore just briefly, legally, when you get someone of that magnitude of skill and talent doing these amazing works of art, and then unfortunately he passes, legally, what happens to the collection of his works? Is the family or you, as such a close person to him, how in the world does that work? What was that like? And you had mentioned at one point you had to go to Dubai, and that was part of this process. Could you just briefly share that? Because I just think that's a very interesting element.
Well, yeah, it's also delineated in, you know, very clear detail in my memoir, because it was something of a legal debacle because of just the sequence of how things happened. But in his case, even though I do believe he had a will that was revised by his lawyer, at the time of his death, his lawyer said there was no will, which sort of mystified me, but I just had to accept it. And so his daughter was the one that he had already expressed verbally that he wanted his daughter to inherit his work, because he was very close to her and she was an artist, and they had a very close relationship. And so his daughter, you know, put his paintings in storage because she was also very busy trying to establish her own life between the States and London. But then years later, when there was an unknown son that, you know, emerged when his work started selling for significant amounts of money, you know, there was this question, because the artist supposedly died without a will, and so his estate was never properly probated. I mean, anybody that dies, their estate has to be probated, and so preferably you die with a will, and so there's no mystery about who gets what. But in this case, it was just deduced that his daughter would have his paintings. And so when it became scrutinized, unfortunately, there was somebody else that he would not have chosen, assigned to be the administrator of his estate. And so the whole thing came under question when the daughter died, who would be the proper heir. And so that is what had to be delineated between Moroccan law or U.S. law. And because he was a U.S. citizen, U.S. law took precedent. And, you know, I would like people to read the memoir to hear the outcome, because it took a long time to be decided and settled. And now it is. And so I can freely exhibit his work to continue to promote his legacy and, you know, help establish his pivotal role in the whole evolution of abstract art, both in Morocco and internationally, because of the very innovative path he paved. So he deserves to be, you know, continue to be recognized and further acknowledged for his extraordinary work.
So the bottom line after that seems like a horrendous tangle of legal items that had to be untangled and dealt with. So where is it now? Who is the representative of his collection? What is the final? Is there a final word now, and how does that work?
Yes, it's called a stipulation. There is a final legal stipulation that the works that I have are completely mine without question, including the copyrights, and that I am the authority on Yacoubi's work. And so when somebody wants to clarify or verify the authenticity of a painting, they will come to me for its examination, and I will either approve or disapprove of it being, you know, authentic, and issue what is called a certificate of authenticity. And so I am now considered the expert, and, you know, the collection that I have, I'm free to show and to do with as I may. And all those other people that are lucky enough to own Yacoubi's paintings, they all, you know, are, assuming they have a legal bill of sale that proves that they purchased the work, are legal and outright owners without question. Sadly, though, right as he became ill in 1985, Tangier was broken into by the landlord because he violated their agreement that Yacoubi would, you know, pay him his rent every time he came back to Tangier. Well, the landlord's son got impatient, and they broke into his studio and just had the local people come and take paintings and letters and antiques from his studio. And so there are a number of paintings that are out there that were never really legally and properly acquired. So that's an unfortunate chapter of his history, very painful, and sort of typical of some of the unpleasant stories you hear in the art world of thefts being made, or, you know, forgeries being made. But that's part of, but because, you know, it's interesting because his work was so desired and so extraordinary. There was a very, you know, acquisitive quality that people had about wanting to have something of Yacoubi's, either his work or his antiques, because he had a very fine eye. His studio in Tangier was beautiful. It had cute, beautiful brass canopy bed, beautiful roll-top desk, other lovely ivory inlaid cabinets and bureaus. And, oh, it pains me to think of how all these things were just toted away right when he, had not given any warning and was just diagnosed with cancer. He had to sort of battle the emotional violation and the physical disease. So he was down for the count.
Well, thank you, Carol, for that sharing of an amazing story on so many different levels. I want to ask my producer, Hercules, how much more time do we have remaining for this particular program?
4 minutes.
4 minutes. Carol, again, I can't think of anyone with more loving ways and smart intuitions than you to be able to handle Ahmed's amazing collection of works. I'm sure that he would be overjoyed that you have taken that position, and I'm sure you've done it so well and just amazing. And I just want to say, if anybody would like a question or comment for Carol or for me, I'm going to give you my email address, which is nicknyny1, and that's the numeral 1, not O-N-E, but the numeral 1, at gmail.com. And if it's for Carol, I will forward it on to her. Carol, absolutely, what a wonderful interview you've done today with me. I certainly appreciate you sharing this amazing story. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for your interest, Nick, and thank you to anyone who's held on listening to this. And I really appreciate all the feedback that you gave me and your interest. So I'm deeply grateful for the opportunity to share some of this. Thank you.
Absolutely. So this is Nick Curto for The Creative Process, wishing you all an enlightened and exciting journey as you find your own path to deeply looking into your own creative energies and more fully developing your talents in whatever many areas of expression your life takes you. Till next time, fully embrace your creativity in one of the more areas of expression. Stay very safe and always be very, very kind to one another. Goodbye for now. Much love to everyone.
And thank you, Nick and Carol, for an awesome show. And thanks to all our listeners. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you got here through one of Nick's resource pages, whether you called in and you're patiently waiting in our queue, or whether you'll be checking us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays, all.